Good afternoon. We're going to call this meeting to order. Senator Romo, I think you are first in the list, so we would appreciate if you could initiate this and bring the people who will be testifying. We're going to hear Senate File 1858, and hopefully members will be, I know that Senator Romo, we don't have a quorum, of course, as you can see, but I'm hoping that members will start to step in. There are several hearings, I think, taking place at the same time, so we're going to try to do our best to accommodate everyone.
But thank you,
please,
Madam Chair.
Please go ahead and start.
Members of the committee, I am very, very pleased to be here today to present to you Senate File 1858. We call this the Healthy Children's Product Act. And this bill is designed to protect Minnesota's children from dangerous, hormonal, disrupting chemicals. These are found in common, everyday products geared for children under the age of 3. You know, over the last several decades, children have faced an increasingly challenging time just making it through what should be the normal stages of growth. Incidents of reproductive defects, childhood obesity, early onset of puberty, and learning disabilities, among others, have increased. Many of these problems have been linked to exposure to toxic chemicals. Of particular concern are those chemicals found in products that children use every day, such as their toys, feeding products. One of those chemicals, known as phthalates, is used to make plastic soft. It's a softening ingredient, and it's found in teethers, for example. The results of this chemical can lead to premature breast development in girls, male genital defects in boys, and reduced sperm quality. Another dangerous chemical is bisphenol A. This chemical is added to make plastics hard, such as in baby bottles and sippy cups. And it brings with it other developmental problems, such as the early onset of puberty, abnormal growth, hyperactivity, and genetic defects that cause Down syndrome. For many chemicals, including phthalates and bisphenol A, there are alternatives. Some major manufacturers have already taken the responsible path toward eliminating these hazards from their products. Yet in this country, there are no laws against using these chemicals. There is no way, in other words, for parents to know whether the products they buy for their babies or children will help or hinder their children's growth. Senate File 1858 will require a phase-out of the manufacture, the sale, and the distribution of children's products, that's ages 0 to 3, that contain phthalates and bisphenol A. By eliminating unnecessary exposure to phthalates and bisphenol A in children's products, Minnesota will become a national leader in protecting children from these toxic chemicals. I have brought a couple of witnesses that can explain the technical aspects. On my left is Lindsay Dahl, who is the project coordinator for Healthy Legacy. And on my right is Dr. David Willinga, the director of food and health programs at the Institute of Agriculture and Trade Policy. I don't know which one of you wants to go first.
I'll go just to walk through the bill.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome to the committee.
My name is Lindsay Dahl, and I'm the coordinator for Healthy Legacy. And I'm just going to kind of walk us through the bill real quickly, but I wanted to give you a little bit of background of who Healthy Legacy is. We are a statewide public health coalition that is working to eliminate toxic chemicals from everyday products. And before you, you have a full list of all of our coalition members, but there's 26 different members that make up Healthy Legacy from across the state. They come from a really broad range of groups. It ranges from the Minnesota Council of Churches, Learning Disabilities Association of Minnesota, Clean Water Action. It's kind of all over the board, people that are coming together to really support this piece of legislation. So if I think the delete all should be in front of everyone. I can just kind of talk through it real quick. It's a pretty straightforward. Yeah, do you have to make them?
Madam Chair, do I have to make a motion to introduce the delete all amendment?
Oh, we have it. Okay.
We don't have a Madam Chair.
We don't have
a quorum, so we can't do that yet.
Yeah, let's wait. Senator Romo, as members come, we will be doing it in a few minutes so that somebody will move it for you. Thank you. Please proceed, Ms. Dahl, with your testimony. We'll take care of the amendment in a moment.
So do you have a bill before you at all?
We have the bill, but we don't have the amendment.
You don't have the current.
Oh, we do. So we're ready. And when we have a quorum, we will do it.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Ms. Dahl.
Thank you. So I think we're just going to start from the very top. We're here today, like Senator Rummel said, to talk about bisphenol A and phthalates that are two hormone-disrupting chemicals commonly found in children's products. So under the definition, Section 1, they're clearly defined of what a children's product is. I think we've heard a lot in the past year about lead and toys. Unfortunately, that isn't the only thing we have to worry about. So there are six different phthalates which are listed out, and thank goodness for all of our sakes, there's acronyms for them. Section 2 is specifically talking about bisphenol A. BPA, for short, is used commonly in baby bottles and sippy cups. And so for any child age 3 or under, any place that BPA would be exposed, it would require a phase-out by the date January 1st, 2009. BPA, it should be noted, is also found in the can linings of infant formula, can linings. Section 3 describes and addresses all six of the phthalates that are listed in the definition section. Phthalates are used to soften plastic. So it's commonly used in PVC plastic. So if you think of vinyl bibs, rain slickers, rain boots, teething rings, anything that's that soft plastic. Rubber duckies, for example, often contain phthalates. And it's used to make the plastic soft and pliable. But again, the six different phthalates are found to be known hormone-disrupting chemicals, and that's why we're here today. Again, the section addressing phthalates has a phase-out date by January 1st, 2009. And I think it's important to note, the date specifically was chosen January 1st, 2009, because that's the same date that was used in the California bill that Governor Schwarzenegger just signed into law that is phasing out phthalates from children's toys, specifically in the state of California. So manufacturers are already reconfiguring, and we'll have to meet that date for the state of California, and that's specifically why it was chosen. Section 4 is just addressing that as we look for replacement chemicals, that the chemicals that are replaced are not CMRs, carcinogens, mutagens, or reproductive toxicants. And then it's clearly listed out where we can find out lists to double-check that. And Section 5 is just permissive language for the states as we move forward. It should be noted that there are currently 11 states working. There's pending legislation in 11 states on bisphenol A and 11 states working on phthalates. Some of those states overlap, but as we're talking about addressing chemicals in our everyday products, we want to think forward about potentially having an interstate clearinghouse, and this language is just allowing the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to participate in that information sharing as we move forward on this. And then I would just also like to note two specific things about the bill. There's specifically, it's been crafted so there's no burden on the retailer. This is specifically addressing the manufacturer of these different products. And so I just think that's really important to highlight. And then another thing to highlight is the concentrations that's in on. The first is on line 2.7 and 2.10. Those are specifically were chosen because amounts above the 0.1% shows that there was an intent to use those chemicals in the product, but it allows the 0.1% allows for some trace amounts of the chemical in the product. And I brought these two rubber duckies up here just not to be cute, but just because the entire bill can kind of be summed up in the story of these two different rubber duckies. So this rubber ducky on my right is a phthalate-free rubber ducky. this one on my left, does contain phthalates. They look kind of similar. They're both soft and squishy. And the one on the left that does contain phthalates is sold in the United States. This rubber ducky that does not have any phthalates is sold to European markets, and they were both made in China. So this just really goes to exemplify the fact that safer products exist. They're already on the market today. We just need to phase out these chemicals to make sure that all of our rubber duckies are safe and parents don't have to make those hard decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dahl. Before we move into questions for Ms. Dahl, we need to move your amendment, Senator Romer.
Madam Chair, is it Senator a delete Corey? All amendment? I would move the delete all amendment to get the bill in the shape that Senator Rummel wants.
All of those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? The amendment.
And then, Madam Chair, I have a question.
Senator Corey.
Yeah. Madam Chair, and so on the rubber duckies, so then if a little child is chewing on that with the, what do you call it, phthalates or?
Phthalates.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That'll cause birth defects?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator, this, yes, the main way that children are ingesting phthalates is by chewing on toys, and that's particularly why it's geared towards ages 3 and under. And what these are, they're preventable exposures, and so we can't link a one time that a child is sucking on this rubber ducky to breast cancer later in life. But Dr. David Willing on my right is going to address those very connections.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Corey.
So is there any links at all to toys like that to, he's shaking his head, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's been a study or something done, I take it. I'll mm-hmm. just listen to the testimony. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Corey. Any other questions for Ms. Dahl?
Madam Chair.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Dahl, I appreciate your being here. I'm looking at your list of coalition members. I don't see any coalition members that represent any kind of university or scientific organization. These are all environmental advocacy groups of one kind or another. And yet in the bill, we have a section called findings. It says that the legislature is making a finding that asserts that this has been shown to do certain things. It seems odd that the legislature would claim to be having a finding made when there is no scientific body that is coming to give us any testimony about the facts on how this is to happen. And I appreciate, and we'll hear, I guess, in a minute from Dr. Willinga, I guess it would be appropriate, if you're going to make a finding, to hear if there's any disagreement with the position that you're taking. Are there testifiers that you have that would disagree with what you're going to say? Do you know if there's anybody that disagrees? That's one of my questions, I guess, is how long have these been used in products, and do the people that manufacture them just agree with you and are trying to get rid of them, or do they disagree?
Senator Rommel, it seems like you want to respond.
Senator Han, Madam Chair, Senator Han, I think if we finish with Dr. Willinga, we might be able to answer your questions.
Thank you. Dr. Willinga, please introduce. Senator Romo. Ms. Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Han. I just wanted to let you know that we actually tried to have someone come from the University of Minnesota today, but he, unfortunately, the leading expert at the U is in Japan right now, so he couldn't come. I'm sure we could get some written testimony from him or something if you'd like to see something like that. And I would also just like to say that IATP, the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, reviews peer-reviewed science, and that's who David is representing today. Thank you.
And Madam Chair and
Senator Han.
Stahl, I appreciate that. And I know that there are many people that work at various institutions that may have different views on things, but I guess if we as a legislature are going to assert that there's a scientific finding, it would seem to me that you'd want to have some scientific body that is recognized as one of the proponents of doing this before we would assert there has been a finding. And I don't see that listed on any of your coalition members. The University of Minnesota is not listed, or other nationally recognized public health organizations or anything of that nature. So, but maybe Dr. Willinga can shed some light on this, too.
Thank you. Dr. Walenga, please go ahead.
Thank you, committee members. So my name is David Walenga. I'm a physician trained at the University of Minnesota, and currently I do public health advocacy and policy. I'm also on the board of scientific counselors to the Centers for Disease Control, National Center for Environmental Health in Atlanta. And what I'm going to talk to you today about is the scientific basis for concerns about these chemicals in these common everyday products that young children are exposed to and why we're concerned about them. So as you've heard, bisphenol A.
Mr. Walenga, yes. I'm going to ask you to please put the microphone
yes.
closer to you because
okay,
we cannot hear
you. Okay, thank
you
very much. As you've heard, the thing that's concerning about both these classes of chemicals is that they are hormone disruptors. And what does that mean? Well, in the case of bisphenol A, it was first designed or manufactured in the 1930s as a synthetic estrogen. And in that sense, it's like another synthetic estrogen first made in the 30s called DES. DES was taken off the market about a quarter century ago after prenatal exposure to it was found to cause later in life adenocarcinoma of the reproductive tract. So now we're going to hear about some similar concerns about early life exposure to this synthetic estrogen, bisphenol A. Phthalates are also hormone disruptors, but they disrupt a little differently. They're anti-androgens, which are so-called male hormones like testosterone. They can also affect other hormones involved with women's reproductive health, like follicle-stimulating hormone, or FSH, and luteinizing hormone. And there's also some evidence that they can interfere with thyroid hormone. So another thing that unites both of these compounds is that the population as a whole is very widely exposed at the part per billion level. Okay, what's that mean? It means that within the population, the typical range at which we are carrying bisphenol A is about 5 to 10 parts per billion, which sounds like a very small amount, but it's still of concern for reasons I'll go into. About 95% of the population, according to CDC data, have levels of bisphenol A in their bodies that are in the same range as those found to cause problems in animals that have been exposed under the laboratory conditions. Okay. For phthalates, there's also very widespread exposure. And in fact, CDC data that's been analyzed by the Environmental Working Group shows that about 84% of Americans currently at any one time have about 6 different phthalates in their body. So the question from this widespread exposure is who's actually at greatest risk? Well, in 1993, the National Academy of Sciences actually looked at environmental chemicals generally and pesticides specifically, but their conclusions were more general than that. And they found that often it's the youngest children maybe even more so in utero, during fetal development, it's the youngest of us that are most vulnerable to environmental chemical exposures for a couple of different reasons. They're more vulnerable because they're still developing. So their organ systems are very rapidly growing. And if you think about, for example, brain development, it's unidirectional. It has to happen in a certain sequence. What guides that sequence of development? Well, in part, it's signaling molecules like hormones that tell the body what to develop, how to develop, and in what sequence to develop. So if those signaling compounds or hormones are disrupted, it can cause downstream problems when that development's thrown off course. Another reason that the very young are more vulnerable is that their defense mechanisms are immature. So, for example, all of us have detoxifying enzymes in our liver, and in the very young, these can still be immature and therefore not as much protection. The blood-brain barrier can be immature and more porous than it is in an adult. The other reason that the very young can be more vulnerable is the fact that on a per-pound basis, they eat more food, they drink more water, they breathe more volume of air per pound. And so any contaminants that are in that water are in the fluids in that sippy cup, they're going to have greater concentrations or greater exposures. And then they have unique behaviors that adults generally don't do, like chewing on plushy toys, for example, or drinking from sippy cups. Adults don't do that generally. So there is actually a large and growing, ever-growing body of science that now links exposures to these hormone-disrupting chemicals with a whole range of different health effects. And I want to just draw your attention to these different endpoints in the left-hand column, and what you'll notice is that they're all related to hormones. So reproductive tract development, of course, when we have puberty, our ability to carry a baby to full term, and then development of our gonads and our reproductive organs. In terms of cancer, there are certain cancers that are hormonally sensitive, like prostate cancer, breast cancer. These have been linked to bisphenol A exposure. Brain development. This maybe is a less obvious one, but as it turns out, in order for parts of the brain to masculinize in a male infant, they have to have some estrogen present. That sounds a little counterintuitive, but what actually happens is that testosterone gets converted to estrogen in the brain, and then the estrogen allows for this masculinization. So what we're seeing now in some studies is that when there is a estrogen disruptor, it can actually affect that masculinization of the brain. And then finally, glucose metabolism, such as insulin is involved in, and weight regulation. These two are linked to hormones. So for bisphenol A, the sort of italicized studies and endpoints are things for which we primarily have animal data. The others are studies and findings for which we have human data. So we'd rather have human data, but for a whole slew of reasons, we often have animal data plus human data or just animal data. They're both important. They're both useful. They both help to make the case that there are links between these exposures and health endpoints. In terms of phthalates, it's a very similar set of health endpoints and science. In animals, something was identified quite a while ago called phthalate syndrome that they saw in young animals exposed to phthalates in a laboratory. And this was things like reproductive tract development abnormalities, changes in hormone levels, etc. And now that we're seeing more and more human studies, again, those that are not italicized, this kind of phthalate syndrome is being confirmed in humans. And so, for example, on the right-hand side, Swan et al. Have actually tracked a population of young boys born to women with a range of phthalate exposures. And what they found is that the greater the phthalate exposure of the woman, the smaller the penis tended to be in the boy born to that woman, the higher their risk for having an undescended testicle, and the decreased distance between their anus and their scrotum. And that's a marker for other reproductive tract development. The study Main et al., again, looked at infant boys born to women who were exposed to phthalates, and they found decreased testosterone levels in those boys. Other studies have found decreased sperm counts and sperm damage in the most phthalate-exposed offspring. Okay? So you get the picture. Now, some of the people that criticize this body of science say, well, yeah, but, you know, there's a range of studies. Many of them are in animals. But in fact, there's a long history of testing in animals to predict effects in people. It's a very valid approach, and in fact, it's an essential approach to protect public health. And in fact, it's the approach that we take for regulating pharmaceuticals. Before pharmaceuticals that are intended for the market undergo clinical testing, they're first tested in animals. Okay. The benefits of animal testing are that you can control for different conditions in the laboratory in a way that you can't in a human study. And that leads to less confounding of the results, greater ease in interpreting the results, and it makes it easier to establish some causality between the exposure to the chemical and the health effect. They're also a lot cheaper. And one of the problems with human studies is that it's really tough to get appropriations or grants for the really expensive, very long-term human studies that sort of definitively say at the end, this causes that, okay? And of course, because those human studies take longer and are more expensive, it means that if you are worried about a chemical, if you wait for the end of that human study, you may be waiting 30 or 40 years, during which time children and others will have been harmed, okay? So a variety of agencies, both federal and international, rely on human studies to predict human concerns like cancer and other endpoints. So this all gets very abstract, so I thought I'd show you a picture. This is a picture of two kinds of rat testicles. The one on the left is not exposed to phthalate, and the picture below shows a very normal-looking testy with a lot of sperm and very ordered structure. The testicles on the right were exposed to DINP, which is the phthalate that's most common in baby products. And what you see in the picture is many fewer sperm and very disorganized structure. Now, this is rat testes, but let me tell you, when you look at a human testy or human testicular tissue, it looks a whole lot like that, because the biology that's the basis for reproduction is basically the same in little mammals like rats as they are in big mammals like us. Another claim is that the low doses to which we're all exposed, on the order of parts per billion, actually are not that concerning. Well, in fact, they are. And I'll tell you why on a number of levels. For one thing, these are hormone disruptors. Hormones are designed to work in the body at very low levels, exquisitely low levels even. So here are some of the part per billion levels that we find of some of these chemicals in bottles that are leaching them, for example. Here are some of the levels in rodent studies, exquisitely low levels where we find effects. On the order of 0.2 parts per trillion in a bisphenol A exposed rat, you will see alterations in the sperm. And at about 2 parts per billion, you'll see changes in the growth of cancer cells that are very reminiscent of human cancer changes. And note that these are about 25 times below what the EPA has set as a safe level of exposure. Now, let's compare this to human pharmaceuticals. What do we expect to be an effective dose when we take an antidepressant like Paxil? Well, in fact, it's 30 parts per billion. For a pharmaceutical like Cialis, the effective dose, again, is about 30 parts per billion. For an asthmatic taking albuterol, it's about 2 parts per billion. A birth control pill like Nuvarina is designed to act at about 0.03 parts per billion. So if you compare that with BAGE 40H, which is a metabolite of bisphenol A found in the blood of some infants, you'll see that, in fact, some of us already are exposed to these chemicals at levels that are 100 to 1,000 times higher than what we would expect a common pharmaceutical to act at. So they sound small, but they're biologically significant levels. Sometimes lower levels of exposure actually matter more than higher levels. And this is a picture from a study at the University of Rochester on another synthetic estrogen called DES. And first what they did was they exposed little mice in utero at 100 parts per billion to DES. And they found that when those little rats grew up to become adults, they were kind of scrawny. And then they repeated the experiment, but at a much, much lower level of exposure, just 1 part per billion. And that mouse on the right is the mouse that grew up after that exposure, and that mouse is grossly obese. And so here you see an effect, obesity, that manifests at a much lower level of exposure than did the animal exposed at a much higher level of exposure. And this just shows that in typical toxicology, we were taught that the dose makes the poison. In other words, you see that straight line on the left-hand side. And in general, that means the more I'm exposed to, the more effect you would expect to see. But with some of these hormone disruptors, we're seeing relationships between exposure and effect that are very different. They're not a straight line. So in fact, you can see less effect at a high dose and then more effect at a medium dose and then less effect again at a low dose. So you get that kind of dome-shaped curve, response curve. And then, you know, I'm going on a little long, so let me just talk about another study that also shows that the dose doesn't always make the poison. And this is a study looking at rat brain. And first of all, let me note again that the male brain needs some estrogen to masculinize during in utero development. And in the rat, there is a protein called aromatase that converts the testosterone in the brain to estrogen to help with that process, okay? So in this study, they actually took pregnant rats and they exposed them to DEHP, a phthalate, and then they looked at the level of aromatase activity, which is kind of a proxy for estrogen. And this is what they found. The higher the exposure to DEHP, the greater aromatase activity, and therefore the higher the estrogen effect. In other words, a more masculine brain. At kind of a moderate level here in green, there was no change in aromatase activity. Okay, so estrogen presence was about the same. But at a lower level of phthalate exposure, you actually see decreased aromatase activity, less estrogen, less masculine brain development. So this suggests, again, that the dose doesn't always make the poison. Sometimes the lower level exposures are more significant. And then let me just end here in saying that the experience with bisphenol A is that over time, what we thought was a safe dose keeps looking like less and less and less. There seems to be kind of a downward line here in terms of what we think is safe. Well, why might that be? Is bisphenol A getting more hazardous somehow? Well, no, of course not. We're getting smarter. We're doing more science. We're getting more sophisticated in the kinds of effects we're able to look at in our studies. And as a result, what we thought was a safe level of exposure when EPA set its reference dose in 1988 now appears much too high. And this is a picture we've seen before. This is a slide from lead. 1961, when I was born, a safe threshold of lead exposure was 60 micrograms per deciliter. Now it's basically zero. There is no level of exposure in the womb to lead that we think is safe. And we've seen the same sort of picture with mercury, environmental mercury, with PCBs, and with alcohol during pregnancy. And so the question is, with what appears to be safe levels of bisphenol A and other hormone-disrupting chemicals dropping really quite rapidly, what are we going to do in the face of that evidence to try and prevent exposures now? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Doctor, are there any questions?
Madam Chair.
For Dr. William. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Doctor. In your testimony, you talked about the level that the EPA has set at 50 parts per billion, but you're suggesting that something less than part per trillion ought to be the level to be concerned about. What's wrong with the EPA? Why are they not addressing this?
Well, I don't know. What's happened is that science isn't static. This is a very rapidly emerging field of research. And simply put, the EPA's level is outdated. It was set in 1988. Almost all the science that I've been showing you has taken place in the last 10 years. So that's roughly 1998, or even in the last 5 years. So, and that's especially true for the human studies that are finding these effects in little boys, for example, exposed in the womb. And so I think just our regulation hasn't caught up with our science.
Well, and Madam Chair and Doctor, I guess one of the concerns that raises for me is that what you're talking about and what you're proposing to us is that we ban something that the EPA at this point doesn't say is a harm. And yet, if it is a harm, it would seem to me that that would be a high level of attention for the EPA, unless there's something going on at the EPA that would cause us to have lack of confidence in that regulatory agency. And I guess that's what my question is. Should we not take any faith in what the EPA does? I mean, if you're talking about something that is causing harm and everybody knows about it, and the EPA is ignoring that, then that would suggest that, what, that there's some issue with how the EPA is? Is that your point?
Well,
is it?
Well, I think, I'm sorry. You know, I think as with climate change and other complex issues, we see that the EPA doesn't always move at a lightning pace, and we're seeing a little of that here where the science is moving rather rapidly. And so there's a lot of indications that to act earlier to prevent exposures would be more prudent than to wait for the EPA's glacial pace. Now, the good news is that we don't really have to settle all the scientific issues because the Europeans have already found alternative ways of making these products that are very doable and that eliminate the exposure. And so the question, I think, is why not?
Well, and Madam Chair and Doctor, I guess that's part of my question is, I guess if we took that argument, we should just ban everything on the theory that it might be harmful, and then if we did that, then we certainly would be safe. Let's ban plastics altogether. Let's ban any kind of chemical product altogether. We could do all that and be proactive and say we don't really know, and so let's take that step. But here we have, at the federal level, an organization that was specifically empowered to do the very thing that we're talking about, which is look at environmental hazards and regulate them to the benefit of the public. And this is not the first time we've had this kind of discussion on other products that we're being told that we should ignore the EPA, that they're not with it, and take your opinion,
right,
which not trying to be with any disrespect, but I don't know why your opinion should be better than the EPA's, for example, and I don't think there's any scientists on this committee. I just wonder, are there scientists? I mean, is part of this is that they don't agree with your view, that there are scientists in the scientific community who say maybe 50 parts per billion is a perfectly safe level and try to create a big furor and get the public frightened about something that there is no need to be frightened about? Maybe this is the prudent thing to do. So is there a debate going on in the scientific community that would say that maybe there's others that disagree with you?
I know that both of the witnesses are just ready to respond. So, Dr. Willinger, go ahead. And
well, one of the leading science. I've been giving you the science, so you know not all of those people could come here to talk to you today, which is unfortunate because they're all very knowledgeable in this area. But for example, Fred Vom Saal is one of the leading scientists. He was the person that was looking at rat prostates in 1997 and first noticed something amiss when these rats were exposed to some of these compounds early in utero. So in 2005, Fred Vom Saal did a literature review, and he looked at 115 different studies showing effects from bisphenol A exposure in utero, and finding that 96 of them, in fact, found adverse effects in those exposed mammals that were worrisome, and they were at the part per billion or even 0.2 part per trillion level. Now, what about the others? Well, of the others, 15 of them found no effect, and all 15 of those were financed by the industry. Of the 96 that did find adverse effects, none of them were financed by the industry. So there is a consensus, but it depends on who's funding the study, apparently. If it's an independent study financed by the government or by academic sources other than industry, apparently there's a fair amount of consensus in terms of the findings.
Thank you. Ms. Dahl, I would like to encourage you to be brief. We have three more people that wish to testify and two who just signed up to testify, and then we have two more bills that we have to hear. So please go ahead.
Yep, thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Han. And I can address your comments from a policy standpoint. I think we all agree that the Environmental Protection Agency, they actually have their hands tied. So from a policy standpoint on the federal level, the reason they have their hands tied is because in 1976, a federal piece of legislation was passed called the Toxic Substances Controls Act. And it was designed specifically to say, you know, there's all these chemicals that we use in commerce today, and we've never actually tested them for their health effects. And so the legislation was passed as a means for the Environmental Protection Agency to assess these and make those recommendations to the public or to different legislatures. And well, what happened is that at the time in 1976, there were 60,000 chemicals used in commerce. The piece of legislation was really flawed because all of those 60,000 chemicals were grandfathered in. So what they said is, okay, after 1976, we're going to start testing and evaluating these chemicals. Well, what we've seen since 1976 is that less than 200 of those chemicals have actually been tested. Only 5 have been banned, and 0 have been banned since before 1990. So the actual legislation kind of has the EPA, it has their high hands tied, because the manufacturers, there's a kind of a disconnect. And the actual testing hasn't been taking place from the EPA standpoint.
And Madam Chair and Ms. Dahl, I appreciate your comment. I don't know that we have anybody here from the EPA that could testify to this or not, but here's the problem, I guess, that I have with this, is that we do have the EPA. My understanding is that they have some pretty rigorous procedures that they put in place when they test things. And you're denying that, but I guess I'm, well, where's the EPA? Why aren't they here to tell us how this works? But from everything I can tell, they have a process that they use. And the intent of the process is to try to find some objectivity in assessing these things so they can make valid recommendations. And I don't necessarily, I'm not saying I agree with everything or disagree. All I'm just saying is that they have a process. What I don't find is helpful is to have a group of advocates like you mentioned this coalition, Citizens for Corporate Redesign, Eureka Recycling, Global Action, Kids for Saving the Earth, Preventing Harm Minnesota, Take Back the Air, PTA, Planned Parenthood, all, I'm sure, wonderful organizations. And the fact that they're advocating for this doesn't necessarily mean that there's a scientific basis for it. And where is the objective assessment about this and the pros and cons? And I'm sure there are. And what's frustrating is to have advocates for a bill on a scientific basis come and tell us their science is right, the EPA is wrong, they're being, you know, have their hands tied, and there maybe there's a conspiracy with industry. And then we're as a panel supposed to say, yes, that's what's happening. And I'm very reluctant to do that. I think if we're going to get into these issues, then I think we need to do it in a way that is procedurally sound. And I don't think that what we're hearing today would pass that scrutiny.
Thank you. No, Senator Wergen has a question that she's been waiting to ask. So
well,
please,
thank you,
Senator
Wergen. If this was asked while I was out, please just, that's fine. I had to step out for a minute. I noticed that you talked about 84% of Americans have greater than 6 phthalates in their body. What you're finding,
time, yeah.
And the phthalates have been around since the 1930s.
Bisphenol A was developed in the 1930s. I don't honestly know exactly when various of the phthalates were developed. Probably at different times.
Can you show me any studies that indicate how many phthalates there were in bodies prior to it being used in toys and baby bottles? Prior to the phthalates being on the market as such. In other words, earlier studies, can you show me the differences since the use of this product?
In terms of
what's been found in the body, that you're saying there are greater than 6 different phthalates. How, I guess the bottom line question is, how can you tell they have come from these toys and bottles?
Well, they come from a variety of different sources, and you're right in that we're still teasing out the exact sources. For instance, a lot of phthalates are in vinyl plastic, so if you have vinyl flooring, you're getting phthalate exposure from the dust in the vinyl flooring. You're also getting them from baby bottles and other baby products. So it's a little hard to tease out where the phthalate in your body or my body might be coming from, which range of products. I think the reason we're talking about one particular kind of product is because of who uses that product. And because of the science showing that there's leaching of the chemical, which is not bound to the plastic polymer, into the liquids and into the person using that product.
But what I'm hearing you say is there literally is no proof that this is the source of the problems, of any problems. You haven't been able to identify X number of children have this because they drank out of baby bottles with phthalates, or they chewed on rubber duckies, yeah. Or you can't identify that at all.
There is a good reason for that. If you or I get, for example, MRSA or some other kind of super infection, right, we can find one particular bacteria causing that infection. It's a pretty direct relationship. That's not the case with chronic diseases. There's never one cause. It's always a mixture of things. Some of those things might be nutritional. Some are toxic chemicals. Some might be our genetic predisposition. It's very hard to tease out the whole constellation of things that contribute to any chronic endpoint like the ones I've been talking about. So in part, to say where's the smoking gun that says that use of this baby bottle causes that, we're never going to have that because it's the wrong question. But what is relevant is that the incidence of many of these things is rising. So, for example, I have a slide that I often refer to that shows that there's been a doubling in the rate of hypospadias, which is an abnormal male reproductive tract, between 1973 and 1993, a doubling. And this is where the urethra, instead of coming out on the tip of the penis, comes out on the bottom or the top. Okay, so it's tough to miss. But that's gone up incredibly. Certain kinds of cancers have gone up significantly as well. Do we know exactly why? We don't. But we do know that these kinds of effects have been linked with exposure to these kinds of chemicals. And we know that some of these exposures are fairly recent. Yep, sorry.
So, Madam Chair, we're sort of Senator doing Warren. This without any proof that it's actually the culprit.
No, the other question
that I had, if you don't mind, one of the things that I heard you say several times is that these two chemicals potentially do harm to the fetus. Is that correct?
Well, that's what all the science that I've been talking about suggests, is that the exposure in utero does contribute to these kinds of endpoints in people.
And I noticed that Planned Parenthood is one of the folks that are on the Healthy Legacy Coalition membership.
Mm-hmm.
Would you suggest that abortion does harm to a fetus?
Someone from Planned Parenthood is here. Perhaps they want to address that.
So something that desecrates and kills a fetus, you're unwilling to address, but this where we don't know it's for sure, you want to take it off the market even though we have no real proof. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wergen. Since I am new to the process, I was going to question the germanings of your question, but I don't know that very well. Senator Dahl, I would like to remind the members that we do have to move because we have four more people that will be testifying on this. And I yes. So, Senator Dahl, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions, if I might. One is on your testimony, Doctor. Kind of in line with what we're talking about here with focusing in on this particular chemical as a disruptor, you've mentioned a couple times about in utero and how it's affecting fetuses. And I know babies chewing on plastics and using bottles is one thing, but now how is it the mother carrying that child getting these chemicals into their bloodstream? You mentioned earlier that it's 5 to 10 parts per billion on a regular basis. Later on, there's in your testimony here, you talked about cord blood having 97.5 parts per billion, which is quite a bit higher than, you know, what's normal.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain how that happens?
Yeah, it's hard to get cord blood to test, so we've actually only got data from 10 samples of cord blood from the American Red Cross that were analyzed in 2005. So that was one of those 10 samples. It was probably a high-end outlier, but the average from those other 10 sample or other 9 samples is that placenta and cord blood are probably in the range of 10 parts per billion. Moms, probably in the same general range. their exposure obviously isn't coming from sippy cups, but it's coming from these other places that are using the same chemicals. We're focused on some of the uses, but you know, these are compounds that are produced in the 5 to 6 billion pound a year range. So they're obviously widely used in a whole variety of different things. And again, the reason we're focusing on these products is because of the concern about the people that use those products being the most vulnerable.
Okay. Madam Chair, if
Senator
I might,
Dahl.
For Ms. Dahl, I'd like to ask, you mentioned that this isn't going to affect the retail business and things like that. Is there a cost difference to manufacture these products without these chemicals? What about backlog of orders of folks that have ordered these products that have them already in? I mean, how is that going? You're talking about changing this over by 2009. Mm-hmm. I don't know if in their ordering cycle, if they can switch over their inventory that fast, what kind of implications it's going to have.
Ms. Dahl.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Dahl. The first part of your question, we look to Europe because Europe doesn't have any phthalates in any of their children's toys. And they anticipated, you know, there's a lot of talk about this is going to, products will be more expensive. It'll cost manufacturers a lot of money. But what we actually found is that the prices didn't change on the shelves, and actually people buying the products actually increased because there was more consumer confidence in the product itself. And so based on what we saw in Europe, we won't see any really difference. And also to address the price cost. Currently, if you go to your local retailer, you can have, there's bisphenol A free baby bottles, for example, that are already on the shelves. And some of those are actually cheaper. They're made out of polyethylene, which is a safer plastic, than the polycarbonate bottles that contain bisphenol A. So the products that are already on the market, we're seeing that there are some that are more expensive, but there's actually some that are cheaper that are safer as well. And then as far as the manufacturers go, the date that was set was specifically set because that's where what was used in the California legislation that passed in October. And so the manufacturers, especially in regards to phthalates, are having to reconfigure already because the legislation was signed into law. So they're going to have to meet the phthalate ban in toys specifically for California. So that's why that date was set, to kind of create consistency for the manufacturers.
Madam Chair, Ms. Dahl, I...
Senator
how
Dahl.
How many states currently have this ban in place?
California is the only state that has a ban on phthalates, but there's 11 states that are working on bisphenol A and 11 states that are working on phthalates currently, and some of those overlap, and I have a full list if you'd like to see it, but I have pending legislation as of now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any more questions?
Madam Chair.
There are two. Yes, Senator Wergen.
I must have missed something. You earlier were talking about babies that are born, for instance, with penis abnormalities, but we're talking about products that are being used post-birth. And if I heard you answer Senator Dahl correctly, you can't identify where the adult female, the mom, is getting the phthalates from. So it really isn't about the baby bottles and the rubber duckies, because if they're born with something that's already wrong and that's post-birth, how does that work?
Dr. Willingham.
Well, sorry. No, we do know where the phthalates are used. We do know how the moms are exposed. We can't tag a piece of dust having a phthalate with a radionucleotide and then track it into a particular mom. That would be difficult to do. But we do know where their exposure is coming from. 90% of phthalates by volume are used in making vinyl plastic, okay? So there is broad exposure to the adult population. So it's not that we don't know. We do know. And those mothers, because these compounds are transferred across the placenta, their exposure sort of becomes the exposure of their fetus as well.
But I think to answer Senator Wergen's question, the babies, especially the newborn babies, are also still very much developmental. So if they weren't exposed in the womb, they could be exposed or further exposed with the baby bottles and the liquids that have been heated up in those bottles, and so further complicate or push the phthalates or the bisphenol A over the threshold. So it seems prudent that, and this seems to be, to me, to be a relatively conservative bill. It's designed only to address products for use of babies or children under the age of three, and it's very specific about these two chemicals that we have adequate science to show us that these chemicals are very nasty players in the developmental sequence of a child's life. And right. The anxiety out there, and we have two parents, if we can bring them to the table to tell us about what their anxieties are as parents. Parents and grandparents ought to be able to go into a store with confidence and know that what they are buying for their children is absolutely safe.
To that point, Senator Rummel, is it correct to say that this measure is a preventive measure so that you want to make sure that the market in the future moves in a direction where we no longer use this type of product? Is that what you're saying?
We have alternative chemicals that can create the same kinds of products that we currently have. So we're asking that our manufacturers use the safer chemicals. That's all we're doing here.
Thank you, Senator Rummel. Any more questions for these testifiers? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to follow up with this, though. We've already said that this exposure could come from vinyl flooring. It could come from the PVC pipes in the wall. I mean, there's all kinds of spoons they might be using. And, I mean, if it's that dangerous, shouldn't this be expanded? And on the other end of it, I see that there's something you sent a letter from the Toys R Us chairman. And can't the marketplace just, take it upon themselves to eliminate these products without having legislation?
Thank you, Madam Ms. Chair, Dahl. Senator Dahl. The marketplace is shifting, and it's moving. As you can see, Toys R Us, the number one toy retailer in the nation, is saying that none of the toys on their shelves can contain phthalates by the year. I think it's 2009. It gives it the same time frame. And I would argue that we shouldn't wait for the market to take care of itself, because there's a responsibility that Minnesota has and the nation has to make sure that these products are safe and tested long before they even hit the shelves. So we don't want the retailers or the consumers to have that burden. We want to make sure that any parent that goes into a store, they know that the products are safe and tested long before they hit the shelves. And that's why the policy piece is so important, because the policy piece would ensure that they're safe, so parents don't have to make a decision of, okay, I can go to Toys R Us after the year 2009, and then I can go to this other store based on when the market is shifting. It would make sure that it's all uniform and all the products would be safe.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Rummel, you have two more people that wanted to testify, and then we have three more people who have signed up to testify after that.
Madam Chair, we have with us Lisa Rasmussen, a mom from Woodbury, and we have Beth Fondell, Director of a Program for Development and Public Policy.
Thank you, Ms. Stolt. If you could go ahead and start. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I moved to Woodbury with my family from Denmark in the European Union 6 months ago. And I'm a mom, and our daughter is now a year old. And since being pregnant and having a baby, my focus have of course been on the world that is surrounding us and our baby. And what has becoming more and more conspicuous are the red alerts about the chemicals that exist in our daily lives and the consumer products that we are dependent upon. For the common consumer like me, who is not a chemist, and I don't have a clue about the chemicals that are going into our products and what it means when they're on a labeling, the world of consumer products is a jungle to navigate through. And I should be able to go into a store and have confidence that the product I'm buying is safe for my family. I had that confidence in Europe. I was able to do this in the European Union, but I don't feel I can do that here in the US. Since 1999, the European Union has banned phthalates from children's products because of health concerns. They have also changed the regulation of chemicals in the way that the burden of proof is now on the industry. It is the industry who must show that the chemicals they use can be safely used and controlled before they are put into production. Due to this regulation, I would believe that the health of people in the European Union is more protected than our health is in the United States when it comes to exposure to these chemicals. I'm not done.
Thank you.
Like all concerned parents, I make an effort to protect my child from harm by taking precautionary actions, such as plugging our electric sockets, securing our stairs, locking our cabinets, and so on. I would like to take similar actions to protect my baby from known toxic chemicals, but it is nearly impossible to do so. I'm very excited about living in the U.S. and in Minnesota. It is a great experience, and there is a lot for us to learn and good ideas and experiences to bring back home. But I would really wish for that I could trust the products that I buy here as well as I did at home. And that is why I'm speaking in support of the bill before you today. There are safer alternatives. U.S. companies who sell products in the European Union are already abiding by these standards, but many continue to sell products in the same products with toxic chemicals in the United States. So, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stolt. Are there any questions for Ms. Stolt?
And there are research done and material to read out there.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Fondell, please go ahead and introduce yourself.
My name is Beth Fondell, and I am here today representing the work and the position of ARC Greater Twin Cities as it relates to Senate File 1858. And we are also a member of the Healthy Legacy Coalition. And we became a part of this coalition because not because we're scientists, but because we have experienced some trends that concern us at our organization. Our Greater Twin Cities, in partnership with our other state and national chapters, have our work guided by the mission that securing for all people with intellectual and developmental disabilities is we want to help them to realize all of their goals as to where and how they live, learn, work, and play. Pretty simple. But our chapter... annually, we support over 300,000 people each year whose lives are impacted. This is in a seven-county metro area, but as I indicated, we do have state and national chapters. And we support these individuals. All of them, their lives are impacted in some way by the presence of an intellectual or a developmental disabilities. And while our work is very rewarding, and we find that people with developmental disabilities have very valuable contributions to make, that we would be delighted to reduce the demand for our services. And one of the ways that we can do that is through the prevention of developmental problems whenever and wherever they're possible. Reducing children's exposure to toxic chemicals that disrupt the hormone systems in the human body is one way to do this. Environmental contributors to childhood diseases cost Minnesota $1.569 billion each year. And that's a statistic that comes from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. Both of the chemicals specified in this bill adversely affect thyroid hormone, which is needed for healthy brain development. Bisphenol A, in particular, is linked with altered brain development and behavior in animal studies. An estimated 17% of children have learning, developmental, or behavioral disabilities at this time. We know that many factors contribute to these conditions, but environmental exposures are preventable contributors that we can actually do something about. We are seeing growing rates of children in special education every day. Nationally, the number of special education students increased 191% between 1977 and 1994. Special education services are costly, as you all well know, and it costs almost twice as much to educate a student with special needs as it does a student without. And because of this expense that is associated with special education costs, we can also save valuable state resources if there is some way that we can prevent some of these conditions from occurring. We also have seen an increased incidence of parents contacting us for services when their children are 4, 5, and 6 years of age. This is a significant change for us as ARC, where previous trends indicated that people were calling us much earlier, that the onset of a developmental delay or some sort of neurotypical behavior was neuroatypical behavior was evidenced when the child before the child was a year or 2 years of age. So that is another trend that we're not quite sure what's going on. I would really like to emphasize that environmental exposures are something that is preventable. Not exposing babies and toddlers to hormone-disrupting chemicals through their toys, baby bottles, or any other items is the least that we can do. Phthalates and bisphenol A they're low-hanging fruit because there are safer alternatives already on the market. And we really hope not to hear from Lisa and her family in the near future because of something that they are noticing that is atypical in their daughter's development. So I'm just asking that we take this important step in protecting young children from unnecessary toxic exposures during vulnerable developmental stages by passing Senate File 1858. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fundell. Any questions, Senator
Han? Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Just you mentioned that there are safe alternatives, and I don't know, maybe Senator Rummel or some of you other. What are those safe alternatives?
Lindsay, do you want to? I'm going to defer to the scientists.
Ms. Dale.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Han. Well, there's a couple different safer alternatives. For example, the phthalate and phthalate-free. There's a chemical called DINCH, which is commonly used, but the most common way that alternatives are used is they're using different plastics. So in the case of bisphenol A, using polyethylene instead of polycarbonate is a safer alternative because polyethylene doesn't have the chemical bisphenol A. So a lot of it's just using different plastics rather than different chemicals.
And Madam Chair, and again, is it possible that there are people that may find that those chemicals are not safe, or in 10 years as our science gets better, as we heard Dr. Willinga testify to, that those chemicals may also be causing some harm or linked to some harm? And my question is, if we pass a law forcing people to use these chemicals rather than today where you have the marketplace do that, would there be any responsibility for the people who have forced it on causing that harm? I mean, are we sure that those chemicals are safe?
Ms. Dahl.
Madam Chair, Senator Han, that's why in the legislation, I'm sorry, I don't have the delete all in front of me, but it specifically has the section, the language specific to say, as we look at those alternatives, we need to make sure that they're not carcinogens, mutagens, or reproductive toxicants.
Any more questions? Thank you, Senator Rummel. I know that the people who have signed up to testify are not part of your group. Thank you. There is Ms. Julie Goodman, who is in the audience, who wishes to testify. And Harry Fish, thank you. And Ms. Twyla Brace. Thank you, and welcome to the committee. If you could start your testimony, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to the science supporting the safety of bisphenol A. I am Dr. Julie Goodman, a board-certified toxicologist at Gradient Corporation, an environmental consulting firm in Cambridge, Mass. After receiving a BS in environmental engineering from MIT, I received a science master's in epidemiology and a PhD in toxicology from Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. And before joining Gradient, I was a cancer prevention fellow at the National Cancer Institute. My comments today are my own, but my participation is supported by the American Chemistry Council. Bisphenol A is a chemical used primarily to make polycarbonate plastic and epoxy resins. Polycarbonate is a clear, virtually shatterproof plastic, and in addition to baby bottles, it is used to make products such as bicycle helmets, sunglasses, CDs, DVDs, eyeglasses, incubators, and components of critical life-saving medical devices. And although baby bottles are not the only product that would be affected by this bill, they are of particular interest because proponents of this bill claim that bisphenol A leaches from polycarbonate baby bottles at unsafe levels. Now, many studies have been conducted to determine how much bisphenol A might leach from baby bottles under test conditions that are relevant for how baby bottles are used in the home. Data from these studies have been reviewed by government agencies around the world, including the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, which has also conducted its own studies, and the European Food Safety Agency, which I will describe a bit later. Based on these studies, polycarbonate baby bottles are accepted as safe for use and are used around the world. Babies are not exposed to unsafe levels of bisphenol A from polycarbonate baby bottles. Now, more generally, people cannot be exposed to significant levels of bisphenol A from use of any consumer products. Bisphenol A is chemically consumed in the manufacturing processes that make polycarbonate plastic and epoxy resins. Only trace levels in the part per million range remain in finished products. And biomonitoring studies conducted by CDC and others, including a recent study including five Minnesotans, one of whom is a Minnesota legislator, confirm that human exposure to bisphenol A is extraordinarily low, orders of magnitude below levels determined to be safe by government agencies based on the science. Now, I personally have been part of 2 8-member expert panels which, over the past 3 years, have been tasked with critically reviewing every published peer-reviewed study that examined the potential for bisphenol A to cause reproductive and developmental effects at low doses. The analysis from this first panel was published in the peer-reviewed journal Critical Reviews in Toxicology in 2006, and the updated analysis from the second panel, which includes bisphenol A studies published through January of this year, was submitted 2 weeks ago to the same journal. In both cases, the panels found that the very low levels of bisphenol A to which humans are exposed are safe. Now, this conclusion has also been reached by several other scientific and government bodies in the U.S., Japan, and Europe. For example, as I mentioned before, the European Food Safety Authority, or EFSA, evaluated the safety of bisphenol A with a panel of 21 independent scientists from the EU, mostly from academia and with no industry input. In their January 2007 report, the EFSA panel evaluated many bisphenol A exposure scenarios, including the use of baby bottles. And they not only found that current uses of bisphenol A are safe, but actually increased by a factor of 5 what they considered to be the safe level of bisphenol A because of all the new available data. Now, it should also be noted that bisphenol A has not been banned by any government body in the world. Now, some people claim that bisphenol A causes a number of health effects, in particular effects on reproduction or development. So how do these individuals come to such different conclusions as those of these panels around the world? Now, essentially, they did not conduct a complete weight of evidence evaluation. They selectively examined the data from individual studies in isolation, and if one endpoint is reported to be altered at some dose and some time point, even if it is not consistently affected throughout the study, they will say the study is evidence of harm. In contrast, a weight of evidence analysis entails first looking at the data from all available studies that examined a particular endpoint together. One should find every study that examines a specific endpoint, take fertility, for example, and then first determine whether the findings from these studies are repeatable and consistent. Then each individual study should be weighted based on many factors, like the number of animals in each study, how many doses were used, and the methodology. Those studies that are more robust are given greater weight in the overall analysis. And the robust studies of bisphenol A include several multi-generation studies, which are studies in which 2 or 3 generations of animals are treated with bisphenol A at all life stages, including while they're in the womb. None of these multi-generation studies found low-dose effects on reproduction or development. So taken together, based on a weight of evidence evaluation and consistent with agencies around the world, current uses of bisphenol A are safe. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Goodman. Mr. Fish. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Harry Fish. I'm a professor of urology, of clinical urology at Columbia University in New York City. And I was asked to come here on behalf of the chemical industry, phthalate group, just to present some of my research to you to answer some of the questions that were asked. But none of the research was funded by any industry source. It was all self-funded through Columbia University. So why am I here? What is my practice? Well, I am a physician. I'm a surgeon. I treat patients who have trouble conceiving, particularly the male patients who have sperm problems and those sort of things. And I started the practice about 20 years ago, and I sit with patients only a couple of feet away as opposed to a little bit more than what we have here. And I started my research by patients asking me, well, you know, I heard that sperm counts are going down. Is it true? So I initiated my studies approximately 15 years ago where we looked at sperm counts, you know, throughout this country. We looked at data from New York State, from Minnesota, interestingly enough, and California. And, you know, to my surprise, because I was expecting, you know, a decline, we did not find a decline in sperm counts. Let me repeat that. We did not find a decline in sperm counts. All this information is published, peer review, and we submit it to you as well. It's also on my website if you'd like to see the actual papers. So we did not find a decline in sperm counts. What we did find was a geographical difference, that sperm counts from one region differed from others, and that's where a lot of the confusion whether there was a decline in sperm counts occurred. But I could tell you that the consensus is there is no data. There's no sufficient data that says there's a worldwide decline in sperm counts. Then came the issue about endocrine disruptors, whatever that may mean, and whether they cause problems in humans. And we heard about this penis abnormality, something called hypospadias, where the penis, the hole is at the tip. If it's on the bottom, that's called hypospadias. A lot of parents are concerned about this, the endocrine disruption issue. And there's actually, somebody mentioned the term phthalate syndrome. We had mentioned that where it really defines something in animals, not in humans. In animals exposed to phthalates, they see a decline in sperm counts, hypospadias, and testicular cancer. Well, I initiated a study again on hypospadias, where I looked at data from New York State and California through the March of Dimes and through New York State, through New York State Department of Health. We looked right now, we updated our data over a 25-year period. Take a guess. We did not find an increase in hypospadias. In fact, we find a decline. That's New York State Department of Health and the March of Dimes in California. That accounts for one out of six babies born in this country. Washington State just also did this analysis. They did not find an increase in hypospadias as well. We heard that incidence was rising twofold. The gentleman before us had discussed that. He presented data from 1973 to 1993. Let me say that that's a while back. That way of assessing data is incorrect. It was abandoned by the CDC for statewide surveillance programs. The statewide surveillance programs are accurate. They account for every single birth, and I recommend that I please do call. You must have a health department here. Ask simply. It takes about one day to get this information. What has happened to hypospadias rates in this state? I will take a guess that it has not increased. We talked about are these problems that we're seeing in animals different than in humans? Well, of course, we're not seeing the problems in humans. People say we need studies in humans, and I find it a little bit disconcerting to me because I had done the studies. I'd like to get some credit for the studies. But unfortunately, a lot of people do not look at those studies. They are in the literature. We cannot extrapolate from the animals to humans, but the human data is there, and epidemiological data that I just presented that is available to you. These chemicals that we're talking about have been on the market for over 50 years. So it's been tested, essentially, on all these patients, and all epidemiological data does not show any abnormalities. I was at a meeting just about a month ago, a month and a half ago in Washington, where some of this data was presented on animals. Shana Swan was there. I asked her specifically, and this is on record, would you recommend, based on your information, on the anogenital syndrome, hypogonadal animals, whatever you call it, whatever you want to say, you recommend passing legislation to remove phthalates? Shana Swan said absolutely not. She didn't say absolutely. She said no. And one of the reasons is we just don't have enough data to really, in humans, to warrant that sort of legislation. And you brought up the issue of, well, if we take it away, what are we going to do? And it was obviously answered. We don't know. These products have been around for over 50 years without any problems that we see. We bring in new products. Now, I got to tell you, I don't know how many doctors work here. Our doctors are here, but I work in the hospital. Everything is plastic. It's an amazing. Everything is disposable, and I worry about the problems that would occur if we remove these chemicals, because we just don't know what we're going to find. So far, we found no abnormalities. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Fish. Just for clarification, Ms. Goodman, are you with the chemical industry as well?
I'm with an environmental consulting firm called Gradient, and the American Chemistry Council sponsored me to come here.
Thank you. Thank you. Wanted a clarification.
Sure.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and doctors, thank you for your testimony. I think you were here in the room when we heard the previous testimony, and I guess I would just like to have your comment. We've heard the argument made that we've got these studies that the other doctor referred to that show that there are problems with these chemicals, and so even though there haven't been maybe direct links, that the prudent thing to do would be to ban them, because there are some levels at which this may cause some problem, at least in some tests. And it seems to me, as a person who is ignorant of this entirely, and just hearing what I am hearing today for the first time, that's the extent of my knowledge, that there clearly is a debate about this, and yet we're being asked as a panel to make a judgment about whether to ban this or not. And so my question would be to you, wouldn't it be the prudent thing to do just to ban these things? Why don't we just do that? I mean, clearly we're not competent and don't have the scientific hearings and don't have the background to assess these studies, and maybe we don't have the time to do that. And so if we can't do that, wouldn't the prudent thing be just to ban these things and move on and tell the public that they're safer now? I mean, is that the prudent thing?
I think there's two answers. Or one is that everyone's talking about alternatives. Not one person has discussed the testing of these alternatives, at least for bisphenol. I can't speak to phthalates. But bisphenol has been tested and has been shown to be safe. So to replace it with something that hasn't been tested and hasn't been shown to be safe could result in something less safe. You just don't know. And the second thing, as I mentioned, with bisphenol, I mean, there have been well over 100 studies on reproduction and development of animals, hundreds when you take into account all of the studies done. And overall, these studies show no effects at low doses. So I think, and there is a consensus in terms of, you talk about the debate, there is only that one panel, which was mentioned earlier, that said that there was a potential for harm. Every other panel throughout the world has decided that it's safe, and as I mentioned, Europe even decided it was safer than originally thought and increased the level at which they thought was safe.
Madam Chair,
Dr.
Senator.
Fish.
I'm getting older, and I've learned by making mistakes over the years. I think all of us learn best by making mistakes. We don't want to make mistakes. We want to learn from our experiences. I could tell you that there are unanticipated consequences of these decisions, unanticipated consequences that we have to worry about, because you know what's going to happen. We're going to have other products, and they may not be as safe as what we have, which has been on the market for over 50 years. One of the things that's important, and this has been discussed in other legislative branches, the issue of accurate information. I'm not saying information that I'm presenting is accurate, as was what you heard before, but you have to have a balanced information, what I'm trying to bring across, that you have to hear what's the entire picture, not just listen to just what's happening in animals, but, hey, paint the picture. Let's see what's happening in humans. We have that data, and you have to ask yourself sometimes, why is that data not presented? Why is data on hypospadias presented that ends in 1993 when I published my own data? March of Dimes have published their data more recently that have shown no increase in hypospadias. And it's not a matter of belief. I just want to share one last thing with you. It's not a matter of what I believe, what you believe. We're not discussing theology here. I tell my students this. I was director of medical student education for the past 5 years at Columbia. Do it yourself. Just call the Department of Health. Look for yourself. The data on Washington from Minnesota is published on sperm counts. And you could look for yourself. It's what's been going on. If there's an increase and there's a problem with hypospadias, well, you may want to do something about it. But I suggest we get more information and more data before you make a decision on banning a substance.
Thank you. Senator Erickson-Ropes, I just want to remind the members that we have only heard one of the bills, and the Education Committee will be convening here, so we will have to reconvene and come tonight. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have one question. Both of you that are testifying, I believe, have ties to American Chemical Council. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then just the question is, who funds the American Chemical Council?
The chemical industry.
Ms. Goodman.
Madam Chair and Senator, I believe it's a consortium of industry, but I don't know exactly who.
Dr. Fish, do you
Madam
have an
Chair,
answer?
Senator, I am a physician and a professor at Columbia, and I'm very happy that the industry has asked me to come down here and has sponsored me to come here and are paying me to be here. I'm very happy about that, but none of the research has been funded by the chemical industry, and that's all I know about that.
Thank you. Any?
Senator
Higgins, we have one more testifier, Senator Higgins, and then we'll proceed to vote. Ms. Brace, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Brace. I'm president of Citizens Council on Healthcare, and I will make my testimony brief. I know that everybody in this room wants to protect children, but I would like to suggest caution be used before policy is enacted without proof of a causal link to healthcare problems, the various problems that were cited here today. By all appearances, many of today's assertions do not appear supported by science. Beyond the fact that the testifiers themselves agree that they are light on proof, I'd like to point out the lack of science noted in the article you received as rationale to vote for this bill. I'd also like to point out the sweeping authority you are being asked to give to government regulators through this bill. But first to the article that you received. And I believe this article is not only for this bill, but it's also for the cancer risk bill that's coming. But if it's called Children as a Vulnerable Population. And so if you look at on the first page at the end of the first column, you'll see that in the last paragraph it says, the causes of chronic diseases and developmental disabilities that are so highly prevalent today are not well understood. If you go to the second column, it says the causes are only beginning to be known. It also says that the U.S. National Academy of Sciences has estimated. And then later down it says it can cause loss of intelligence. It doesn't say it does. And it also says certain pesticides appear to interfere with brain development. And then if you go on to the second page, it talks about in the first column the implications of these findings, and in the second column that they are now thought to arise and appears more likely to lead to disease. Nothing in here is conclusive. It's all, and this is the article that is supposed to convince you that this is a bill that you need to sign. Now I just want to go to the bill and point out the authority. And if you go to the second page, section 4, and I am on the delete all amendment. So on line 215, this is talking about that the manufacturer shall not replace these with other chemicals. And so on line 215, it says, or reasonably anticipated to be a human carcinogen, which means, of course, that nobody knows. But that would be something else that we couldn't make toys or other things with, or this on page line 18, identified by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency as causing birth defects or reproductive or environmental harm. That's very sweeping because actually those are not even defined in this bill. What is a birth defect? What is reproductive harm? And what is environmental harm? And so the regulatory authorities would be able to classify and define that on their own. So I'd like to point that out, and I'd just like to give a concluding statement to say that we really don't want to write a law that's going to tell parents that one rubber ducky is harmful and the other rubber ducky is not, when in truth we have no idea whether or not the other one is or is not harmful. And since we have no science here, real science, to point out that this is harmful, then you as legislators really need to think carefully before you pass a bill that gives the regulators all this authority. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 1858 as amended be recommended to pass.
Madam Chair.
Any Senator Hand.
I'd like to offer an amendment, an oral amendment, to strike lines 1.22 through 1.28 and the delete all amendment and renumber the subdivisions appropriately This is the findings section of this bill. Typically, we don't do this, as my understanding, in the legislature. We try to avoid asserting our opinions into law. And I really object, and I think we ought to object, to the claim here that the legislature has made a finding when we have not made any such thing. We have heard some testimony, and we've asked to accept a bias or an opinion. I don't think we should dignify that with the title of a finding, and so I would move that we strike that from the bill.
Senator Rommel, I need to ask you to please come back, and we need to hear your response as the author of this bill.
First of all, I would urge members of the committee not to support that amendment. We could sit here and argue the science forever. We are not scientists, as Senator Hahn said. But knowing what we know about the power of synthetic estrogens, do we want to put them in products for babies? That's what this bill is about.
Thank you, Senator Rommel. Senator Worgen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I would urge you to vote yes to the amendment simply because we don't have the practice of inserting findings into law. Longtime members of the DFL here in the Senate have recognized that that's inappropriate in law. Senator Don Betzold, for instance, always makes motions to take out findings because he finds them very inappropriate to put in law. And I'm asking members that this be stricken from the bill.
Senator Rommel.
This bill will be going through the various committees that can clean that up in terms of what Senator Betzold or the... I would like to keep the two chemicals in the bill, and striking this section removes bisphenol A from the bill.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Rommel, it only removes the paragraph that's titled findings. It doesn't remove the prohibition in the next paragraph.
And Madam Chair, I need to amend
Senator
my amendment.
Hand.
There's a second section on findings that mimics the first, starting on line 133 and extending over to 2.4, and Senator Higgins is right. Senator Rommel, I'm perfectly willing to have the debate on the prohibition. I just think that the findings language is not appropriate, particularly since we haven't really made any.
Thank you, Senator Hahn. Let's give a moment to Senator Rommel. Senator Rommel.
I'd have to talk to my...
Please go ahead. Just to clarify, Senator Hahn, your amendment is to delete the findings portion of the bill, correct?
Madam Chair,
so
that's correct.
Both. Could you please clarify,
yes.
Senator Hahn, for us?
The two sections, one on page one, lines 1.22 through 1.28, which is subdivision one of section two, which is titled findings, and then further in section three, beginning on line 1.33, extending over to line 2.4, which is the findings section, subdivision 1 of section 3, to delete those two paragraphs. Senator Worgen has stated this is not a common practice to insert those things, and I am very uncomfortable with our legislature making this kind of a statement in a statute.
Senator Rommel.
I was looking at the wrong lines.
I was too. I apologize.
So I was very confused. The amendment is okay.
Okay, all of those in favor of Senator Hahn's amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Higgins, please proceed.
Now I'll move my original amendment that Senate File 1858 is amended, be recommended to pass. Does it need to go anywhere else?
It needs to go to Commerce.
Commerce?
Mm-hmm.
Goes off to Commerce. That's my motion.
Any discussion on that motion? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to say that this is really typical of bills that come to us where there seems to be clear evidence on one side, clear evidence on the other. and this will probably be a classic default vote. And I just want to make sure that, you know, we understand how this is, what this is doing. Either you believe in protecting consumers, in this case, children and the most vulnerable citizens we have out there, or you believe in protecting the industry, in this case, would be big chemical companies. So I would like to have a roll call vote, please.
A roll call has been called, and we'll Senator Hahn.
Chair, and I guess I would just want to offer a countervailing opinion to Senator Erickson Ropes. I don't think this is anything about industry and doing protecting children. I think this is about whether this body and the legislature is got the ability to make the kind of judgment that we're asked to make here. We are not a scientific body. We have regulatory agencies that are empowered to do this very thing. I find it ironic that we heard testimony earlier saying that we couldn't trust the EPA's regulation on these chemicals, but here in the bill we're saying that we're going to trust them to, for as far as replacement chemicals, to tell us which are the ones that would cause defects. So how does that work? That on the one hand, we can't trust them because they've set a level of acceptability that our testifiers say is not appropriate, but on the other hand, in the bill, we say we are going to take them as the authority. What this really is about, in my opinion, members, is who do we trust? And what we're being asked to say is don't trust the EPA, don't trust the Minnesota Health Department, don't trust our own bodies, but trust some testifiers that have come before us and have claimed to know more than anybody else, and asking us to ban the chemical on the basis of that. And so, members, I'd urge a no spill.
Thank you, Senator Hahn. I think we need to vote. We have heard Senator Wergen and Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really do want to make a response to Senator Erickson-Rope's comment. In my opinion, and from my own personal point of view, my vote has absolutely nothing to do with protecting chemical companies. It has to do with not having heard definitive science that this is a bad product. It also has to do with the fact that by moving from this to something else that is not nearly as significantly tested, we could easily be moving from something that's relatively safe to something that's incredibly dangerous. I would say that that is not protecting the public.
Thank you, Senator Wergen. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, over the years that I've been here, we have told our regulatory agencies what to do about lead. Another thing that is lead poisoning is totally preventable, and our state agencies are behind everybody. You know, they're right there with even the Consumer Product Safety Commission is finally now telling people a better standard than what the EPA and our state agencies are. We've told people what to do about phosphorus in all kinds of things. That's what we do here, Senator Hahn, is we try to weigh the best scientific interests, the best evidence that we can come up with, and make a direction for our state that is hopefully in terms of protecting our citizens. And so, sorry if you weren't compelled by the scientific evidence, but I'm voting yes. So.
Thank you. It seems to me that it's time to vote because I don't know if we're going to convince each other by now. We have heard all the scientific evidence that we can hear. So let's proceed. A roll call has been requested, and staff is ready to call the vote. Please, Karen, proceed. Call the names.
You start with the chair. Thank you.
Senator Marty. Okay. Senator Torres Ray.
Yes. Aye.
Senator Berglund.
Aye.
Senator Dahl?
Aye.
Senator Erickson Ropes?
Aye.
Senator Fischbach?
No.
Senator Hahn?
No.
Senator Higgins?
Aye.
Senator Johnson?
No.
Senator Corrin? No. Senator Lori?
Aye.
Senator Lynch?
Aye.
Senator Prettner-Salone?
Aye.
Senator Wergen?
No.
There has been 8 ayes, 4 noes. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Rommel.
Thank you, members.
We now need to hear from Senator Anderson, Senate File 2999. Senator Anderson, is she in the room? Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Senator.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Senator, I hope you have free samples for us.
Well, after you hear what I have to say, you might not.
Of the good ones, then.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and committee members. Oh, this is Senate File 2999. I saw that number the other day and thought, boy, we have a lot of bills. This bill relates to Safe Cosmetics. And it was so interesting to sit and listen to the last discussion. And I think what I would say that all of our constituents believe and most Americans believe is that government makes sure that all the products that we use every day are safe. But it's really not the case when it comes to cosmetics and personal care products. As early as 1978, the US GAO, the General Accounting Office, told Congress cosmetics are being marketed in the United States which contain ingredients that may cause cancer, birth defects, central nervous system disorders, and other chronic toxic effects. And I was really surprised when I started learning about this issue as someone who uses cosmetics to find out that they are not really regulated. I assumed that the Food and Drug Administration would regulate what's in them, what the ingredients are, and make sure that they're safe. But the fact is that the FDA does not have regulatory authority over cosmetics. Their website, the FDA website, says cosmetics and their ingredients are not required to undergo approval before they are sold to the public. This means that manufacturers may use any ingredient or raw material except for color additives and a few prohibited substances, and they can market a product without government review or approval. The FDA does not have the authority to require manufacturers to file data on the ingredients that are in cosmetics. It's a self-regulated industry. It's voluntary by the industry to test the products and to determine what's safe. There's almost 7,000 ingredients in personal care products. The vast majority of them have very little health or safety data available. So focusing on trying to ensure to do a risk assessment for every one of those chemicals or ingredients would be extremely difficult. What the European Union has done is they've taken very strong action in recent years, and they've actually banned the use of 110 chemicals in personal care products. And I'm not proposing that dramatic of an approach today, although I do think that the FDA should be empowered to require companies to test all the chemicals in their products and to demonstrate their safety. That's not what's required. But we should encourage companies to develop safer alternatives. A few companies have signed a pledge to stop using toxic chemicals and exposing consumers to unnecessary risks. The European experience has taught us that major international cosmetic companies are very capable of making cost-effective and safe alternatives since they've adapted to the regulations that passed in Europe. And they still sell cosmetics and personal care products overseas. So one thing I want to show you, we did a little homework assignment and got three European fashion magazines, one from Great Britain, one in French from France, and one from Spain. Cool. So these were just brand new. We'll pass them around if you want to read them later. And just picking one randomly, the Elle magazine from Great Britain. We just put some Post-it notes on some of the cosmetics ads. And you can see that They're advertising and selling the very same brands that are advertised and sold and bought by the millions in the United States. Estee Lauder, I went through and found them, Elizabeth Arden, Herbal Essence, which is Clairol, L'Oreal, Maybelline, which is owned by, I forget which major company, St. Ives, Lancome, they're all in here. All of those ads are in here, as well as articles describing the benefits and, you know, some of the really nice products that are available. So what we know is that companies are managing to adapt, and they are selling products, the very same products in Europe that we are buying with dangerous chemicals in them in the United States. Now, that doesn't seem appropriate. It seems really outrageous to me that Americans should be the testing ground for chemicals in cosmetics that are known to be dangerous. That's wrong. So what I learned in, you know, I just heard about this in the last year, and I started doing a little research, and I found that there's a really great website by a group that put together, it's called the Skin Deep Database, and we can log on to it in a moment. And what they did is they tested, we hope, some 25,000 cosmetic and personal care products and analyzed exactly what is in those. And they list them. And we have some findings to share with you about some of those cosmetics, some of which many of you may use. So I think we'll have our testimony now, if we may, Madam Chair. We have two college students, two young women, who have offered to come today and talk about some of the cosmetics that they use. And then we'll tell you about some of the research that we've done. So I've got with me Katie Gasper, who's a Bethel College student, and Madeline Kovacs, who's a McAllister College student. And they'd like to speak to you briefly.
Thank you, Senator. Who's going to speak first?
My name's Katie Gasper. I'm a student at Bethel University.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Gasper.
Yeah, thank you. Just as a concerned citizen and as a young woman especially, this bill is extremely interesting to me. I use varying beauty products daily, ranging from standard face wash to makeup. When I get prepared for my day, the thought of whether my beauty products are safe has rarely run through my mind. Up until researching the beauty products, I naturally assumed that everything in the items I used was safe and good for me. Upon investigating the ingredients within my products, I've gained the knowledge that this is not the case. I use the Environmental Working Group Skin Deep Database, as Senator referenced, to research my products and the ingredients within them. I'm not going to open this up because it seemed to leak in the little bag that I brought with. But in the morning, I usually use this Neutrogena oil-free acne face wash, which just seems natural, normal face wash. On the Skin Deep Database, it gave it a moderate hazard, a score of 5 out of 10, 10 being the worst product and zero being the best. I learned that it's been linked to allergy problems such as impaired capacity to fight disease and repair damaged tissues in the body, issues of bioaccumulation, ingredients contaminating other animals coming in contact with the product, and potential to last in the body even after death. Various contamination concerns such as environmental pollution. The active ingredient in this, I found out, is called salicylic acid. It's found in fragrance. It's an anti-acne agent, exfoliant. Currently, it's restricted in Japan and Canada. In the U.S., I found that it's subject to concentration limitations, but not completely restricted. One or more animal studies show brain and nervous system effects at low doses, which is called neurotoxicity. It's also known to be persistent and bioaccumulative in wildlife. I also have mascara, which is Maybelline Great Lash Mascara. I know a lot of my friends use this as well as I do just because it's good mascara and cheap, so I assume that it would also be good for me. But it also has a moderate hazard score of 5 out of 10. It's been linked to cancer, developmental and reproductive toxicity, allergies, and immunotoxicity. The active ingredient in this is triethylamine. It's also found in fragrance. It's known to be a human immune system toxicant. One or more animal studies show sense organ effects at very small doses. also show endocrine disruption at high doses. It's had relations with asthma, reversible bronchoconstriction, which is narrowing of the bronchioles, initiated by the inhalation of irritating or allergenic agents. I also have my shampoo bottle here today, which is just Pantene Pro-V. It is also moderate hazard, 5 out of 10 score. The one thing that I actually noticed when I was researching this one was, which actually came up with all three products, is the fragrance that's listed on here. It doesn't say anything specific about what is in this fragrance. It just simply lists fragrance. So when I researched this more in the database, it just simply said that fragrance has a very high hazard score simply because we don't know where the origins of this fragrance is coming from, and it's not fully labeled on most products, and that was very worrying to me. So simply, as you can see, these are three basic things, not anything too overdramatic, and even these things have issues within them with the ingredients.
Thank you, Ms. Gasper. Ms. Kovacs, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Madeline Kovacs. I'm a senior at McAllister College, and I am also here testifying as a consumer who was sort of unaware of, first of all, the lack of listing of a lot of the different health effects that a lot of ingredients can be listed to, and then also the lack of listing at all for the ingredients included in a term such as fragrance that is found on the labeling of products. As a consumer, I would hope that toxins would be heavily monitored in substances that I'm applying directly to my face and body every day. I also have certain products that I use, you know, every day and every evening, from putting the makeup on in the morning to washing it off at night. It's a daily routine, so it's daily exposure. I am an environmental studies minor at McAllister, and I still did not know that the EPA does not regulate most substances that are found in a lot of these projects. The EPA, in fact, they're swamped. They get over 7,000 requests for new patents on chemicals every single year. In fact, the chemicals that are related are regulated are a very short set list of things that are actively being regulated. So I looked up on the Environmental Working Group site a few products that I use. The first one that I want to show is Maybelline Full and Soft Mascara, waterproof brownish black, every morning.
This is actually my mascara, so I use the same kind, or at least I used to.
I am wearing it now. So this product has ingredients in it that have been linked to cancer, developmental, reproductive toxicity, violations, restrictions and warnings, allergens, immunotoxicity. And there's a huge list here. And then the way that they break it down is actually very interesting, because then they also list toxins with a high hazard warning. So that's like a 7 to 10. So those are toxins that have been shown again and again to be related in trace amounts to a lot of health effects. And this particular one was linked to this particular chemical is triethylamine, and it's linked to cancer, allergies, immune toxicity, and organ system toxicity, among other things. So this mascara has potentially been linked to things that can cause cancer and can cause reproductive problems. And that was very shocking to me that that would not be labeled as such on the packaging. The next one that I looked up is not, it's not actually on here, was Makeup Forever Matte Velvet Oil-Free Foundation. This product contained aluminum starch octanil succinate, which also got a high toxic warning. I don't know what these chemicals actually are, but inside of this chemical it includes arsenic, lead, and heavy metals, and that's in an oil-free foundation, which I thought was a really good choice because it has an SPF of 20 and I'm kind of fair-skinned, so I thought I was, you know, being more careful with regards to the sun, when in fact I'm, you know, there's a potential that I'm putting arsenic, lead, and heavy metals on my face. It's not encouraging. Another product that I use a lot of is Laura Mercier Lip Color Cream, the romance color. And the thing that sparked my interest on this particular product was fragrance. And I'm sure we'll get into this more later, and Senator Anderson will go over it as well, but fragrance itself is listed as an ingredient. Well, we all know that there are chemicals that make up fragrance. And again, as Katie also pointed out, this is given a high hazard rating just due to the lack of any labeling whatsoever as far as what chemicals are in said fragrance. And another one that I would like to point out that I was like really kind of worried about was this one that my mom uses, Revlon age-defying makeup and concealer compact with Botafirm, and she'd probably kill me if I told you that. But this product itself had the highest hazard rating that the Environmental Working Group could give it because it is listed to the ingredients in the product are linked to endocrine disruption, enhanced skin absorbent, developmental reproductive toxicity, and the list goes on. You can read it right here. The reason that this was really shocking to me was because of the hormonal impacts of this. And, I mean, my mom is at, you know, the second period in her life where she's, you know, her hormones are affecting her person. how do I put this nicely?
Her skin.
Yes, her skin. So
tell me about it.
Really
I know
shocking.
This.
Right, I mean, and it's just funny that I... Hello. That something that's going to be targeted towards a that will be consumed by a particular population that's of a certain age would also have effects that are like closely associated with hormonal changes, and like that sort of like had a warning bell for me. Anyway, we'll get into that later. What else? I would just like to I'm taking a long time. Wrap up by saying that. The FDA regulations do not follow a precautionary method, and only a few substances must be approved before they are introduced to the market. I should not have to look up. I mean, the chemicals themselves are listed. As a consumer, again, I'm not a chemist. I should not have to look up every single chemical, read through the scientific literature, decide for myself whether or not I want to take the risk of being exposed to a heavy metal or carcinogen, something that, you know, might cause reproductive or any slew of problems later on in life. And then it becomes a question of consumer risk. Consumer risk and, you know, intelligent decisions by consumers as to what they're exposing themselves to only applies if the consumer has the information available to them. And if they don't, they're not making decisions given all of the information. They're being given basically no information as to either, for example, what is listed, what chemicals are in fragrance, which is in everything, or, you know, you can list five chemicals and someone's like, oh, okay, I read these chemicals, I don't know what they are, but the EPA does, right? Well, sort of, and they shouldn't have to make that decision. So, sorry. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kovacs.
Madam Chair?
We have to move quickly through questions as we have Senator Rummel would like to get her testimony today because if not, we have to reconvene tonight. Senator Higgins, Senator Anderson, excuse me.
Well, Madam Chair, we do have a lot more examples, but it sounds like we don't have time for them. I do have a delete all amendment, so I need to explain the changes to the bill I'm proposing.
Please, Senator Anderson, go ahead, and then Senator Higgins, if you could introduce the amendment for
Madam
Senator
Anderson. Madam
Chair,
I'll move to A2, delete all amendment.
Thank you. Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson.
Well, do you want to adopt it, and then I can explain
it? I don't know if you wanted to talk to speak to it.
Madam
all
Chair.
Of those in favor of the
Madam
Senator
Chair.
Higgins.
On line 1.21, dibutyl phthalate is spelled wrong, so we probably ought to fix that. After the PHT, there has to be another H, so we can incorporate that in there.
Did the staff get that? Okay, so the amendment will move with that grammatical correction. All of those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Originally, the bill would have adopted California's law, which calls for disclosure by cosmetics companies of the products they sell in the state. Because California is already doing that, and I learned after I introduced the bill that they're intending to make their database public and available to other states. So it seemed rather duplicative. And so we tried to narrow this bill to what we could do that would be the simplest but would make a big impact without going to the next step of trying to ban products, but rather just to provide disclosure to consumers, because we really don't think you should have to be a chemist to buy makeup. It's just wrong, and it really breaks my heart to see young women using products like this every day that could affect potentially affect their long-term health and their reproductive systems. That's just scary. So what we did was focus on the fragrance issue in particular, because what we determined is that there's a loophole and that federal law, which requires labeling, we have all these examples about disclosure of ingredients, required. Federal law only requires ingredients to be listed, but fragrance can be listed as fragrance, even though it can contain, and usually does contain, possibly hundreds of chemicals that make up one fragrance. And so that's the piece that isn't disclosed. And so we know that one of the dangerous ingredients, or potentially very dangerous ingredients in fragrance, can be dibutyl phthalate, and that's why we name that in particular. But all the other ingredients in fragrance, we really don't know what they are. And so this is an effort to have a consumer disclosure and to have at least information available so that consumers can try to do their homework and become more educated and make good decisions to protect their health.
Thank you, Senator Anderson. Any questions?
Senator Hand. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Gasper and Ms. Kovacs, appreciate your coming and your testifying. Just a couple of questions for you. In the course of the research that you did you contact any of the manufacturers and ask them why they would be producing products that would be of harm to their customers, why they would want to continue to do that? Secondly, I also wanted to know the website that you referenced where you got the information. Who funds that website, and why is that a more reliable source of information than the EPA?
Ms. Kovacs.
Thank you. Sorry. First of all, we're not discounting anything the EPA is saying. We're not accusing the EPA of giving any sort of false information. We're just saying they don't have the authority to regulate these chemicals, or they don't require full disclosure. And so we're not in disagreement with the EPA at all. First of all, no, I did not call the companies. Although I'm fairly confident that if I had, they, of course, would tell me that they would look at the, I mean, we just saw the scientific debate that happened in the last hearing, and I'm sure that they would cite numerous studies that would say the dosage amounts or whatever you're applying or whatever you're using, of course it's safe. Well, there's science to contradict that, and I think the problem lies in, you know, in, at the very least, a consumer should have full disclosure of all the chemicals that are in the product and should be able to go find out what is in them and to be able to make their own decisions. If you can't even do that, then you're exposing yourself to numerous chemicals with no way to find out what those are.
And Madam Chair and Ms. Kovacs, I appreciate that. I think, though, it would be... it would aid to the credibility of your presentation to say that you had talked to manufacturers and this is the answer they gave. Part of my question would be, their reasoning would be not to put this on their label. And I, the only reason I raise that is I came from a food manufacturing company, and we were subject to a lot of USDA and other kinds of regulatory requirements, some of which governed labels. And the more stringent the requirements are to do labeling, the higher costs that are incurred to do that, and the more frequently you have to change. You may be buying from a supplier, and the suppliers may be meeting your standards as a specification, but they may put ingredients in there that at some time or other might have to be labeled. And so I guess the question I have is that without knowing what the impact that is or why the industry doesn't do what you are advocating, I think it's very hard for us to say, well, we have this dispute. Some people say this. Some people say this. But we should go ahead and do what you're telling us, even though we don't know why the industry is doing what it's doing.
Well, Madam Chair, if I could
answer that. Senator Anderson.
I mean, the law requires that they disclose certain ingredients. It doesn't mean they have to say mercury, mm-hmm. lead. They can use it. They can use other terms for these chemicals that are not quite so obvious to people, so you have to do a little bit of follow-up work. But I don't think that they are disputing that those chemicals that we talked about do exist in these products. I guess I haven't heard them argue that that's not true, although in some cases they're being phased out. But it kind of misses the point because this bill isn't trying to establish who's right and who's wrong about the science. That's not what this bill does. This bill says we just have a right to know so that we can at least do the research ourselves. In Europe, they've taken a stronger approach and said we're going to ban them, and they have made a decision about the science. And, you know, you could argue whether it's cheaper to ban them and to require them to reformulate the products and just sell us the same products they sell in the EU.
Yeah.
That would be my preference, is if they would just do that, if they would meet those standards. And I think in some cases that is happening. But right now we're just asking for them to at least disclose the information so we have information.
Thank you, Senator Anderson. I really need to be careful with the schedule because Senator Rommel is not going to be able to bring people tonight, and she's been patiently waiting.
I'll pass.
Okay. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Anderson. My question is not along the lines of the merit of the bill, but rather just in the practicality of implementation of the bill. And I wonder if someone could speak to this bill talks about specifically what the labeling, and I'm talking about section 1.20 to 1.23, would be for the state of Minnesota. Does that pose any concerns in that would potentially our requirements in Minnesota be different than, say, of some neighboring states or other states? And I just wonder about the practicality.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, the dibutyl phthalate requirement would require specific, you know, information on the labels that's different than in other places. And we're focusing on that in particular because, you know, that is classified by the EPA as hazardous. And it is in the phthalate family. And so we do have a great deal of data and peer-reviewed studies about that. The rest of the ingredients would be posted on the website, so obviously that could be easily done in a way that would not affect packaging or labeling.
Thank you. Any more questions? Senator Erickson-Ropes and Senator Higgins.
Oh, I was just going to move the bill.
Go ahead, Senator.
Could you, Senator Higgins, please?
Madam Chair, I move that Senate file, what number are we? Here we are. 2999 is amended to be recommended to pass. So where does it go? To go to Commerce?
It's going to Commerce.
Okay. And I'd like a roll call, please.
A roll call has been requested. Any further discussion?
I have to keep
Karen
busy.
The staff, are you ready? excuse me. Who called me? I don't know.
We were on the witness list to testify.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't have your name. Yes, please. Go ahead.
Sorry, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I had called staff and asked if we could be able to testify. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah, no, I didn't have your name. And
my name, for the record, Madam Chair and members of the committee, is Phil Griffin. I'm a lobbyist appearing today on behalf of Johnson & Johnson. I have with me Sharon D'Agostino, who's Senior Director of State Government Affairs for Johnson & Johnson. We appreciate the opportunity to speak to you briefly today on Senate File 2999. We had an opportunity to speak with Senator Anderson after the bill was introduced on Thursday, and we met with her briefly on Friday afternoon. We just saw the Delete All Amendment about an hour ago, and really appreciate Senator Anderson's willingness to work with us on this. If I can just briefly speak to the major agenda item before we turn to Ms. D'Agostino. As we look at the bill as it's currently listed, we have no objections to the provision at 1.20 relating to if the fragrance is used, disclosing the contents of dibutyl phthalate. And our concern relates more to what is going on in the next sentence after that at 1.22, and we would ask to have that final sentence stricken on fragrances, and I'll turn to Ms. D'Agostino, who can give you more information about why we oppose that provision.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Sharon D'Agostino. I'm with Johnson & Johnson. And Johnson & Johnson is the world's most comprehensive and broadly based manufacturer of healthcare products, including numerous cosmetics lines, Johnson & Johnson baby products, Neutrogena, Clean & Clear, Aveeno, and Lubriderm. I am here also as behalf of the Personal Care Products Council, which is the council that represents over 600 manufacturers of cosmetic products. As Mr. Griffin mentioned, we've been working with Senator Anderson the last 48 hours, and we appreciate that dialogue. The concern we have, and I do have a packet of information about a U.S. consumer website for people to get more information, and about the voluntary reporting that manufacturers do of their ingredients to the FDA. In particular, the line that Mr. Griffin mentioned, the concern there is fragrances are protected under confidentiality agreements. We do not make the fragrances. They are provided to the manufacturer, and those are protected by trade secret. We have limited information of what makes up a fragrance, although, as already been mentioned in the committee, hundreds of ingredients go into the establishment of a particular fragrance. So the concern we sent with mentioned to Senator Anderson is we'd like to work with her on this bill to see how we might go about making that something that we can work around some of the trade secrets. If we were to identify, for example, a couple particular ingredients that they were interested in, then we could ask our fragrance manufacturers if they would provide those to us, and we would list it. But because of trade secret, they will not give us their formulations and their ingredients.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, excuse me, change chairs. If there are further questions, we'd be happy to try and identify them, and we will continue to work with Senator Anderson if this bill moves along from committee. If there are questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Senator Worgen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, in view of what we've heard, I'm going to move to amend the motion to remove the sentence beginning on line 1.22 with all other fragrance and ending on line 1.23 ending with website.
Senator Worgen moves line 22. Could you repeat that?
Deleting that last sentence of the bill, essentially. All other fragrance ingredients in the cosmetic product must be listed on the manufacturer's website. I think we've heard some of the difficulty with that, and frankly, with the rest of the bill, I don't see a huge problem.
Mr. Chair, I would prefer the committee not delete that sentence. I think the point is that consumers don't have information about what's in fragrance, and I appreciate we've tried to talk with each other, but we've had very limited time to do that, and so we did talk about this very briefly. I guess my answer would be that I'm not sure why fragrance is protected by trade secrets, but all the other ingredients are not, because federal law just sort of created this loophole for fragrance. But as Ms. D'Agostino said, they have hundreds of chemicals in them, and I just think we're defeating the purpose of the federal labeling law if we don't provide that information as well. Because, you know, I know these companies don't want to be selling products that have toxic components in them, but if you don't know what's in this, if you buy fragrance from another company without knowing what's in it, you may be selling things that are toxic. And so I think we should ask these companies to ask their vendors to tell them what's in their fragrance and just post it on the website. It seems to me it's not that difficult. So I would ask the committee to leave that language in there, and I certainly will continue talking with the industry and see if we can find some common ground on this as we move forward.
Mm-hmm. Further discussion on the Worgen Amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Chairs in doubt. All those in favor, raise your hand. All those opposed? Motion does not prevail on a tie vote. Is it? Does not prevail. Further discussion on the bill. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just say one thing. I'm drinking a Diet Dr. Pepper here, and all the ingredients are listed on the side. And in particular, there's a note here to people who have phenylketonuria, you know, if there's something in here that would cause them problems if they ingested it. And there's a lot of stuff in here I probably shouldn't be drinking. But it's on the side, and I can make a decision about whether to buy it or not. So it seems to me that this bill is a right-to-know bill. Do people in your hometowns have the right to know what they're rubbing on their face or spraying and inhaling? And if it's just information, And I doubt there's going to be any proprietary problems because we get all the list of ingredients in our cookie containers or whatever, and I'm not making Keebler cookies in my kitchen. So I doubt that people are going to run away with, you know, proprietary secrets, you know, that are on the side of a container. So I would urge the committee to vote in favor of letting your constituents know. Just let them have the information.
Mr. Chairman, I know we're not in a debating society, but if I could very briefly, Senator Erickson Ropes, we are not trying to say we are not interested in listing our ingredients. We are interested in listing our ingredients and do. The question is those things that are outside of our control. And I think you'll see that when you look at those food ingredients, you also see things like flavorings and other things that are listed. And that's the same kind of trade secret that we're trying to deal with here. If there are concerns that you have about chemicals that should be listed, that's what we're asking Senator Anderson to work with us on so that we can list those specific items without trying to deal with the trade secret items. And I hope that we'll have the opportunity to reach an agreement on that as we move through. I appreciate greatly the time of the committee members and Senator Anderson today. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins renews her motion that Senate File 2999 as amended be recommended pass and requests a roll call. Okay, the Secretary will call the roll.
Mr. Chairman, could I just clarify the motion? Was that to be referred to another committee?
Commerce.
Yes. Commerce.
Commerce Committee.
And Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Just I wanted to clarify one thing for Senator Lynch, because she had asked a question earlier, and I'm afraid you might have been out of the room when the industry representative said that they were fine with the first requirement that you had expressed concerns about labeling the dibutyl phthalate. So I just wanted to be clear that you knew that.
On the Higgins motion, Secretary, call the roll.
Senator Marty?
Aye.
Senator Berglund?
Aye.
Senator Dahl? Senator Erickson Ropes?
Aye.
Senator Fischbach?
Yes.
Senator Hahn?
No.
Senator Higgins?
Aye.
Senator Johnson?
From Senator Johnson and Johnson.
Coring. Senator Lori. Senator Lynch.
Aye.
Senator Prettner-Salom. Senator Torres-Ray.
Aye.
Senator Worgen.
No.
On a 7-2 margin, the motion does prevail.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We are at 3 o'clock, and there's another committee waiting to get in here. Senator Rummel, can your witnesses come back either next some other day? I'd rather not have an evening meeting tonight for people. Can your witnesses come back or?
Is it possible?
Or Mr. Chair, can we move to another room and just finish up?
If we have 10 minutes, he will give us 10 minutes for your testimony at least.
Yes.
Maybe we can process it in that time. Well, if the committee is leaving, that doesn't serve you very well. So
come back.
Don't mind a different date. Okay. With that, this committee is adjourned.
Right. Yay.
Yes.
No, bonding committee. Is it bonding tonight?
Oh, okay.